Okay, well, the first question is a very big question. What are the basic books to study Marxism? Now, Marxism is enormously, huge territory. But if you're thinking of classics, then one of the simplest expositions used to be in the old days, a very elementary exposition by Emily Burns, What is Marxism? But that's a long time ago. Since then, we've had many books at many levels. As I said the other day, one could start, if you're completely new, you can start with Lenin's The Three Sources and Component Parts of Marxism, and then move on to Communist Manifesto, read Marx and Engels' German Ideology Part 1 on Feuerbach, read Engels' Socialism, Scientific and Utopian. Then read Engels' Dialectics of Nature, which is a statement of dialectical materialism. You could also read a very brilliant exposition of historical materialism in a very brief space. It's given by Marx in his review of Proudhon's Philosophy of Poverty. So Marx's counter to that is a book called Poverty of Philosophy. And that book, published by the New World Paperbacks, has a letter from Marx to the Russian doctor Annenkov. And in about 12 pages, Marx does a review of Proudhon's book, which is also a statement of historical materialism. That's one interesting source. I mean, I've done this over the years and dug out many sources, but yes, Marx's letter to Annenkov. You'll also find this in Marxist.org. If you go there, and you can find this Marx's letter in Marx's correspondence. The person he wrote to is a man called P.V. Annenkov, a Russian doctor. That's a good short source. Marx's own preface to the contribution to the Critique of Political Economy contains a very brief exposition of historical materialism. So if you want to start with basic historical materialism, you could start here. My first chapter also does the same thing. You could, of course, then go on to read many more things. I mean, this is where I'm just saying you can start. If you want to specifically look at Marx's Capital, then I would obviously recommend that you go through my book, which is essentially a very close and rigorous presentation of Marx's Volume 1. But there are other books as well, which people have historically been recommending. And especially economists, and I'm not sure that all of you need to do this, but those of you who have a background in economics might also want to look at something like Paul Sweezy's P.M. Sweezy, Sweezy, Theory of Capitalist Development. Many of these references were in my book. So, if you read my book, you have all these references that I'm talking about now. The list goes on. I mean, if you didn't want to move from Marxist political economy in the time of Marx and Engels, I already mentioned to you that you could read David Ryazanov. And I had mentioned also, as a very simple exposition of a materialist view of history, the book by Leo Huberman, Man's Worldly Goods. But going beyond that, certainly I would next go on to read Lenin's Imperialism, because Lenin's Imperialism, a little tract, apparently a small tract, actually brings up to date the Marxist analysis of capitalism beyond Marx's time. Marx, passed away in 1883, and Engels put together Marx's Volume 2 and 3 of Capital, but that took quite a while. After that, perhaps the most single critical text which analyzes the development of the capitalist economy on a global scale from a Marxist standpoint is Lenin's Imperialism. It's subtitled The Highest Stage of Capitalism. In some versions, it is the last stage of capitalism. The old Progress publishers used to have it as the last stage. That's a very good, strong, empirically grounded pamphlet to read. And it's probably a basic understanding of the transformation in world capitalism between the 1870s, which is roughly where Marx's work ends, and the beginning of World War I, 1914, those 40 years, what exactly happened to the world capitalist economy is something that is brought out. And you must remember, this was actually the very important period, because throughout the 18th and 19th centuries, capitalism expands globally. But it especially expands globally, especially in terms of financial globalization, roughly from the 1870s to 1914. So in a sense, that period is in some ways a mirror of what we are going through now, the current phase of financialization. Very different in many respects, obviously, but some pointers are there in Lenin's work, which help you to understand what's happening in capitalism today. So in that sense, Lenin's imperialism is extremely important work. There's also other works around that. I mean, Nikolai Bukharin wrote a book on imperialism and the world economy, which is, you know, more turgid prose. I mean, Lenin's is obviously more sharp, in my view. But you could read that. And of course, there are books that Lenin made use of in the course of writing imperialism, like Hobson's book. But I wouldn't go that far. I'd just stick to Lenin. We're all pressed for time. So this much for up to World War I. Then beyond that, there's been much more that's been happening. And there's a lot of writing. There's no single work that I can cite. So let's say that for the purpose of this series of lectures, we start with Lenin's three sources. We do the manifesto. I mean, you do the manifesto. You read the manifesto. You read Engels' scientific, socialism, scientific and utopian. You read Marx and Engels' German ideology, part one on Feuerbach. You read Lenin's imperialism. You also read Engels' dialectics of nature. That's going to give you a fairly good grounding, along with Ryazanov and Huberman. That'll give you a good grounding. There are, of course, other standard textbooks which have been used in the past. For instance, there is this work by Maurice Kornfurt. At this point in time, I don't want to burden you with too many references to read. Just read a few core classics. Then we can always discuss matters as we go along. Okay? That's on the question of basic studies. Marxism is too large a word. I mean, what you have in mind is Marxist political economy, and more specifically, the political economy of capitalism. And Lenin brings the story up to date, up to World War I. After that, there have been many analyses of what's happened subsequently. And they are there not only in academic textbooks, they're also there in the programmatic understandings of various communist parties across the world. And some of that is really worth learning from. I mean, we tend to, especially if we are academics or if we have our own very strong opinions about existing Marxist movements, we tend to dismiss mass movements on the ground as somehow, you know, infradig or not adequately theoretical, and we are making a big mistake by doing so, because they are practically trying to explore and implement their understanding of the world, and there's a lot of rich lessons that one learns from that. Whether the efforts succeed or not in any particular point in time, there's a great deal that one learns from mass movements based on Marxism, as opposed to just academic studies alone. Both are important, I think. I'm not dismissing the importance of academic studies, but I think it's important also to look at the programmatic understandings of various communist movements across the world. Okay, that much I think we'll do for the time being. We can come back to these questions later if you like. Then there is this question, very long question, that Marx talked about crisis, and the point, of course, is to change society. Can I lay out a roadmap for the change? Obviously, I cannot. But what will the socialist economy look like? Very important questions. I don't underestimate the importance of these questions, but these are very cosmic questions. Should it emulate the state planning model followed by USSR? Let's first of all remember that all these socialist revolutions of the 20th century took place in countries or in societies where classical Marxism would have least expected you to find them. These took place in really backward countries. So Marx and Engels, especially Marx's analysis in Capital, suggested as capitalism, you know, leads to more and more centralization and concentration of capital, the emergence of monopoly capitalism, that will ultimately lead to a position where the working class is able to take society forward to socialism as the absurdities and irrationalities of capitalism become more and more evident to the mass of the population. But that is the classical understanding there, the working class as the leading force in making the transformation. However, historically, and Lenin's imperialism gives you a very good understanding of why revolutions occur, you know, tend to occur elsewhere than in the advanced capitalist countries in the early part of the 20th century. And in fact, it's remarkable because Lenin wrote the book Imperialism in 1916, before the Russian Revolution. And while he makes the main point in that little booklet that imperialism implies war all the time, he also made a very important statement there saying imperialism is the eve of proletarian revolution. Now, in fact, that's exactly, it's almost as if he predicted the Russian Revolution. Of course, he wasn't an astrologer, but he was making an analytical point that it's possible for this to happen. So obviously then practically all the major revolutions, Russian Revolution, subsequent East European advances, Chinese Revolution, the Vietnamese, and so on, all of these occurred in relatively backward countries, which meant that there was no classic model for them to follow. I mean, you must first of all understand, I think it's important for us to have this understanding all the time, that what we are talking about when we talk about a transition to socialism is an enormous challenge that, you know, you expect even a particular society, not all of humanity, but even a particular society to consciously regulate itself, plan its activities. That's a huge leap. Hasn't happened so far in human history, right? So the Soviet Revolution was the first such attempt to consciously plan society and its growth. Remarkable, but that it was not allowed to succeed is a different matter. I mean, so it's to be expected because the Russian Revolution faced enormous opposition from day one, having occurred in a backward country, not having had a sufficiently advanced and strong industrial working class, not having had the advanced and productive forces that would normally be expected as part of a transition to capitalism. The Russian Revolution had to perform the many tasks that capitalism performed in the Western world without capitalist relations, in other words, without an exploitative way of doing it, without colonies, without access to technology, in fact, facing a boycott all the time, facing invasion. Within 6 months of the Russian Revolution, you had troops from 14 countries into Russia, helping the white armies. Because the Western capitalists understood what was at stake. Because here was the Russian Revolution, which said in 1917 October that workers can run the economy, we don't need capitalists. Can you think of anything more devastating than that thought, that you don't need capitalists? That's why the Western world is very particular that we must not allow this revolution to survive. It took a long time for them to crush it. And it took a lot of mistakes from the Soviets to enable that to happen. But don't forget that for 70 years, 74 years to be precise, we had an economy which was run not by capitalists, but by the entire people. There are many contradictions there. I mean, the backward has itself created many issues, and the capitalism's, imperialism's encirclement created many issues, and so on and so forth. I don't want to get into that now. I mean, we must at some point maybe also talk about the Russian Revolution and so on. Likewise, the Chinese Revolution, you know, 30 years of a long peasant struggle led by a working class party, and then again, enormous opposition from the rest of the world. Today, you know, the Western world recognizes, is made to recognize, is compelled to recognize China, even though they were exulting over the fact that the USSR collapsed in 1991, they couldn't kind of quite get rid of China. And so many people who don't study these matters carefully, glibly say that China has become neoliberal, it's, you know, like any other capitalist countries. I don't want to get into the business of labeling China. I'm not particularly qualified to label it. I've not even made a revolution in my country. So, I mean, I'm certainly not going to be so immodest as to label China today. But I would certainly say that the Chinese experiment, the Chinese experience gives you some more practical experience of the struggles and the contradictions in building socialism in any given territory within a globally capitalist world. That's a huge challenge, especially if you're backward. Practically all the socialist countries that we have today around us are countries which made the revolution when they had not even developed anywhere along the path to fulfill its capitalism. So laying a roadmap isn't easy. The points made here in the question are well taken, that we don't follow the USSR, we don't follow the Chinese, but we learn from both. And we then say that depending on our concrete context, we try to go to the next stage. Now, in the specific case of India, for example, I would say that we are quite far from a socialist revolution, because we have not even quite settled our accounts with pre-capitalist production relations. We have not settled issues with landlordism, which has now become much closer integrated, much closely integrated with the capitalism of the Indian economy as well. So we have a task of making what some people call a people's democratic revolution, but I don't want to get into all that. I don't want to use terms that most of you would not be familiar with, or some of you would not be familiar with. Let's just say that this question is a very, very difficult question, but we do have the last bit of it where it says, can you give some examples of successfully collectivizing production and distribution processes? Well, the USSR itself is an outstanding example of how collective production and distribution worked for more than seven decades in the midst of the most hostile attacks by capitalism, including the Western world's nurturing of Hitler and fascism as a bulwark against Bolshevik threat. Don't forget that history. In the 1930s, the Western world did everything possible to use Hitler and fascism to undo the USSR. They couldn't. Ultimately, the USSR saved them from fascism. Although today, you find this wretched literature in Europe and among the political classes, you have this nonsense of equating fascism with socialism as practiced in the USSR. Whatever its limitations might have been, you can't equate these two, right? And I think it's important, therefore, to understand that there are clear empirical evidences, examples of collective production in agriculture and in industry and in services. And today also, there are clear examples in China or in Vietnam or even in the former USSR, in the republics of former USSR, where collective entities continue to function and continue to play an important role in the economy. And I think this is true not only of the countries where a socialist revolution was made, but even in the capitalist countries. There's a fair bit of evidence that in one form or another, large-scale modern production and distribution demand forms of collectivization. Marx had this remarkable assessment in Capital Volume 1, where he looks at the joint stock company and says that this is the abolition of capitalist private property, but within the limits of the capitalist mode of production. Because joint stock company with limited liability means you're socializing capital, but you're socializing it within the limits of capitalism. In other words, you're socializing, essentially, you might say, losses, but profits remain private. This is what we're seeing all the time. But I think this is this needs a longer perspective of understanding, where you see that it's not a one-shot affair. Building socialism doesn't happen overnight. And across the world, different experiences will accumulate. And it may take many, many more decades for us to arrive at a better understanding of what could be the necessary, if not the sufficient, conditions for building socialism, and what a socialist economy might then look like in any particular area of the world at a particular point in time. So yes, it is concrete. It can't be, specified as a textbook model for anybody. But I think the experience of the last 100 years suggests that the socialist way of organizing an economy, planning and organizing an economy, is eminently feasible. In fact, when the USSR's experiment started, mainstream economists simply denied the possibility of socialism. There's a whole set of fellows, von Mises, Friedrich von Hayek, and so on, who wrote on the impossibility of planning. They said markets do so many things brilliantly without any planning, but you can't do it in a socialist economy. And people like Oscar Lange and others refuted these arguments. There's a huge literature on this also, if you want to read it. But again, I don't want to get into a very academic kind of explanation, because this is what we do in our courses, that we give you references and you can read. But let me just put it this way, that yes, there is now enough experience accumulated by humankind that tomorrow we needed to run an economy without capital, without business, without corporate entities. It is possible to do so. And you will in fact find that even now, at a time of any crisis, like even the current crisis, the state comes in a big way and plays a very important role. And I think you must trust the common sense of people and their experience over time to ensure that the state doesn't become an overarching and dominant presence, but can in fact be democratized and decentralized in many ways through collective efforts. And we have our own, you know, the Indian left's contribution in this regard is often not even recognized. I mean, you know, you can look at a state like Kerala right now. It's a very limited state government. They're not socialist or anything like that. They're part of a bourgeois landlord Indian economic system. But look at the way they have dealt with decentralization, democratic participation. There are many experiments and many lessons. Nothing overarching, nothing that's like a formula. But I think all these lessons, every effort to build or to advance towards socialism gives us rich experience, which then becomes an aid in going forward. And I think that our problems come up because we expect this road to be simple and to happen tomorrow. No, it won't. And there'll be ups and downs. There'll be, you know, advances and retreats. But quite clearly, if you go back and look at the fact that it took capitalism about 200 years to move from a tiny part of Western Europe to the world, whereas within, which happened by 1900 or 1914 or so, within the next 50 years, by the 1950s, 1/6 of the world's territory and 1/3 of the world's population lived in countries that considered themselves socialist. They may not have qualified for your or my textbook definition of socialism, but these were conscious attempts at building a socialist economy. And I think that's how it's going to be. It's not going to be a textbook socialism. It's going to be experiments, refined with experience. And I think we should all be open to learning and not be overly dogmatic about what socialism should look like. Okay? I think that's a very longish answer, but I hope it at least provokes more thinking among you. Can I go on to the next question? Okay. Now, the next question is about price. There are two questions there. One is, does the rarity of natural resource underlying a commodity determine price in the long run? And why not? Why or why not? Well, you know, first of all, you know, you must understand that when you say long term as opposed to long run, see, the term long run in mainstream economics is used in the context of the freedom to change the size or scale of operation. See, the short term in bourgeois economics means a period when the stock of capital equipment is given, and the only thing you can vary is the variable input, which is labor. The long run in bourgeois economics signifies a period during which you can change machinery, you can expand the scale of production, you may even have a new technology. Now, in the bourgeois economist notion of long run equilibrium, we had referred to this earlier. We had said that the price of a commodity in a capitalist economy in the long run must at least ensure that the producer gets the cost of production met, including rate of profit on the capital invested. Now, this question about natural resources being rare and so on, let's look at oil. I mean, after all, when oil becomes terribly expensive, then you start exploring alternatives to oil. Let's look at rubber historically. Synthetic rubber emerged as an alternative to natural rubber. So, you know, under capitalism, given the drive for profit, the growth of productive forces is always going to undermine any presumed rarity of a particular natural resource, determining what will happen or not happen. So I don't think one should. That is why, you know, the focus on price gets you here. Natural resource, price, scarcity. Marx was not talking about prices. Let me make it clear again. Marx was talking about value. And let's remember, value for Marx at the qualitative level was the social property of all commodities in a capitalist economy, that they are all the products of expenditure of a certain amount of society's labor time. The quantitative aspect was that the magnitude of such value could be measured by the amount of labor time, I mean, average under average social conditions. So this is nothing to do with prices in the market. There can always be spikes in prices, rise, fall, whatever, depending on the specific conditions in any particular market at any particular point in time. So let's not confuse the analysis of prices or any given, you know, at any given point in time in any given market with the social question of value. Why does Marx spend so much time talking about commodity and value? only to bring out with clarity what is fundamentally happening in a capitalist economy in terms of classes. His focus was on classes, not on prices. The whole idea of value is part of an analysis that is going to look at classes and, you know, demonstrate to you how to understand the fact that as capitalism keeps, you know, moving, more and more of the means of production become the property of a fewer and fewer set of capitalists. And the bulk of the working people continue to keep working for a wage or a salary. They may at best buy a house or maybe go for a holiday or maybe live better off than their earlier generations did, but they do not become large corporate entities. You could, of course, talk about shareholder capitalism and people's capitalism and all that, but all this is bogus because, you know, at the end of the day, the controlling interests are not distributed over the entire population. So, you know, I mean, I think let's not get bamboozled by things like the stock market and a larger number of people holding shares in companies and so on. Basically, there is a capitalist class and there is a very large body of working people. Since Marx is working with an abstract and simple model of capitalism, which allows for two classes, capitalist class and the working class, he's not going into all these specifics. Although if you read Capital, and that's why I'm saying you should read Capital after you read my chapters, that he gives a lot of examples of how you understand all this within the context of the evolution of capitalism in the Western world. So again, this rare natural resource in a very short period can be a factor in spiking prices for sure. I mean, there's a huge oil shortage in a particular year, given a very high level of demand in the world economy, that could lead to a rise in price of oil. But tell me, how does oil price fall from $150 to $30 without any technological change? Clearly, here it is a question of monopoly and of non-economic factors also coming in. Like, for example, if you want to squeeze the Russians or the Iranians, you want to drive down the price of oil. So don't confuse determining price in a particular market at a particular point in time with the more fundamental question of how does capitalism work and how does surplus value get produced under capitalism and how does the capitalist class get to appropriate the surplus value. These are the questions that Marx is grappling with when he does his value analysis. So don't get confused between value and price. Let's leave it out. The fact that Marx, you know, states a hypothesis, that you can begin with the hypothesis that commodity exchange has the values, is only a convenience. And it comes from the experience of the period of petty commodity production in the transition to capitalism. But it doesn't mean that prices under capitalism get determined by only labor values. And prices on any given day in any given market are determined by many other factors. And Marx talks about that a great deal, as I said, in Volume 3 of Capital. I have talked a bit about it in my chapters, so go and take a look. Now, the next question is about the stock market. Stock market is of critical importance in a modern capitalist society. For whom? I mean, the question says, how do you combine price changes in the stock market, the labor theory of value? You don't combine them. Stock market is the most illusory market you can have. The stock market, okay, one can talk about primary shares. You know, when you are starting a company, you want to raise capital, you issue shares, people give money, and then you start a factory. That's one kind of operation. But most stock markets are dominated by what are called secondary trades, right? When there are stocks that exist already and they are being bought and sold. So stock markets create no wealth. They transfer claims to wealth from one set of participants to another set of participants. So it doesn't have anything to do with value creation or wealth creation. All this nonsense that you get from the Prime Minister and the Finance Minister about how our corporates are the ones who create wealth in this country, all that rubbish can basically be ruled out. The labor theory of value does not seek to address the issues concerned with the functioning of a stock market. Stock markets, yes, they do redistribute wealth among the participants in the market. They don't produce any wealth. So you have these huge headlines about $24 billion of wealth destroyed. What they mean is stock market valuation of X number of shares. So what? Has anything been produced there? Ultimately, unless something is produced, you can't think of a surplus. You can't think of a surplus. You have a surplus of, you know, papers, securities. What's the point? So I don't think one should try and mix up the analysis that is addressed in the labor theory of value with a much more concrete and, you know, definitely important analysis of financial markets in the contemporary world, including stock markets. I'm not dismissing the importance of studying the stock market and trying to understand how it functions. That's a separate issue, but don't mix it up with the labor theory of value, because that's not the question that labor theory of value seeks to address. Okay, value. What do we mean by quantitative labor time involved in the production of a commodity? Exactly what it says, that take any commodity, it has come through a number of stages, right? So you may have started with raw material, which would have been processed by labor at the primary level, then it would have, more value would have been, more processes would have taken place. At each stage, living labor is added using machinery and working on the raw material provided. We discussed this in the labor process last time. We said that the living labor performs the following tasks. One, it retains and transfers the value of the raw material into the product. Second, it transfers a certain portion of the value of the means of production, the instruments of labor, into the product. And third, it adds the new value in terms of living labor time. So that's really what we mean. We mean both the direct and the indirect labor time required to produce a commodity. We call that the value of a commodity. So value of a commodity is the amount of labor time directly and indirectly expended in the production of a commodity. And of course, we add the proviso that we are talking about this under average social conditions, so that so you don't inflate value by being lazy or being unproductive. So that's the point. So what is the distinction between saying that the common factor among commodities is being portions of total expenditure associated labor time and being portions of expenditure associated total labor? Don't worry about this. This is, you know, when I speak, there can be sometimes not identical expressions of a point. Point is quite clearly that what is common to all commodities? It can't be physical and chemical properties. It can't be natural properties. The only commonality among the most heterogeneous commodities that you find in any capitalist economy is the fact that they are all products of society's labor time. Okay? That's good enough. I mean, beyond that, how you phrase it, don't worry about it. This is the basic core point. And you can talk about society's labor time only by abstracting from specific kinds of labor. So you're talking about labor in general, in a way. And that's possible under capitalism, because in capitalism, there is increasing labor mobility. And therefore, one does realize on the ground that one can talk about labor in general. Of course, we are not saying that all labor is the same. Certainly, skilled labor would count for more than simple unskilled labor, right? But don't forget that under capitalism, what you consider skilled labor today would not be considered skilled labor tomorrow, because machines will come and new methods of production will come. So let's not get lost in that. Basically, what we are saying is that the commonality across all commodities is the fact that they're all products of society's labor time. And in order to be able to say so, we need to think of labor in general, not any specific kind of labor. Okay? That's what we call abstract labor or labor in general. Whereas this relates to the value aspect of a commodity, whereas the use value aspect of a commodity relates to a specific kind of labor that leads to its, you know, production. Okay, let's leave it at that. Now, when we discussed about social necessary labor time, what role do authorities play and ruling class? You see, this is what the questioner has in mind. But for example, to the extent that infrastructure improves, it may become possible to produce a commodity in lesser time than was the case earlier. The basic point is that the amount of socially necessary labor time to produce a commodity refers to its production under average conditions of labor in society. In other words, there may be an advanced technology, but that accounts for a very small proportion of output. There may be the existing technology, which accounts for the bulk of the output. So until such time as the existing technology is replaced by the new technology, in a sense, the existing technology will largely determine the socially necessary labor time. But over time, obviously, this is not going to be the case. the existing technology will go, the new technology will come to dominate, and that would then dictate the idea of the measurement of what is the amount of labor time required to produce something. I mean, like I said, the weaving by hand as to weaving by machine, huge difference, right? But to begin with, if weaving by hand is the main activity, that will determine the amount of labor time on the average. The ones who are doing weaving by machine will get an extra benefit by being able to produce the same output in a lesser amount of time. But the value at that time would still be the one that is associated with the dominant mode of producing a commodity. So that's why we're always talking about average social conditions. We keep in mind that this is going to be changing and so on. Okay, but at any point in time, this is identifiable. At any point in time, you know that to produce a commodity X, it takes so much time on the average. Some factories may, you know, have a more advanced technology, but by and large, this is the labor time required to produce it. What we are guarding against by using the term socially necessary labor time is not to privilege an extremely backward technology which takes much longer time than the average. Okay? All right. There is a specific way to calculate exchange value, namely socially necessary labor time. Here, I think I must intervene and say that Marx starts by talking about exchange value. Okay? That he says every commodity has two aspects. One is the use value, the other is the exchange value. By use value, we refer to the physical and chemical properties of an object that make it useful to somebody in society through its function. Okay? By exchange value, you are talking about the rate at which it exchanges for some other commodity. Then later on, we said this exchange value is only a phenomenal form. Underlying that is really something else, which is what makes all different kinds of commodities comparable and exchangeable and thus commensurable, is the fact that they are all products of society's labor time. And that is the qualitative commonality. The magnitude of value is measured by the amount of labor time, and that is where the qualification socially necessary labor time came. So in terms of the question number four that you're asking, is use value also something we can ascribe a number to? There's no question number. Use value is the set of physical and chemical properties which make a product useful. Unless a commodity has use value, nobody's going to buy it. Now, in mainstream economics, there's a very different approach to this issue. There, for example, the typical way in which mainstream economics looks at prices is by asking you to conduct a mental experiment. Suppose you have 100 rupees with you. Oranges cost 10 rupees per piece. Apples cost 20 rupees a piece. How many apples and how many oranges will you buy with the 100 rupees that you have? And then they make an assumption that each apple I eat gives me a certain amount of satisfaction, subjective satisfaction. And the satisfaction may decrease as I eat more and more of apples at the same time. Likewise, each orange gives me a certain amount of satisfaction. And so what I will do as a rational person is to allocate my 100 rupees in such a way between apples and oranges that the last rupee I spend, whether I spend it on oranges or on apples, should give me the same satisfaction. Because if that is the case, then I have no reason to change my decision. In other words, it is a notion of an equilibrium. Equilibrium is when you see no need to change your decision. The extra satisfaction per rupee spent is equated across commodities. Economists call this the marginal rate of substitution and so on. I mean, I don't want to confuse you with all the jargon in economics. But there, you see, the whole thing is subjective. It is my utility function, my specific desire for something. And, you know, there's no way this can actually lead you to the discussion of the entire market, because the conceptual experiment you will be doing is to hold everything constant, all incomes constant, all other prices constant, and hypothetically vary one price and keep asking people in the market, how much will you buy at this price, how much will you buy at that price? And that's how you construct a demand curve. This is an absurdity, right? I mean, nobody constructs a demand curve like that. But because mainstream economics does not accept an objective basis for value and for the process of exchange of the rates of exchange among commodities in the markets, it falls back on a subjective theory of value. In Smith and Ricardo's time, during Marx's, in Marx was living and before him, those economists like Smith and Ricardo accepted labor theory of value because Marx improved on that a great deal, fundamentally transformed it. But once the labor theory of value became, once capitalism got established, you must remember that Smith and Ricardo were people who were there during the period of rise of capitalism. Smith's Wealth of Nations came in 1776. Ricardo's Principles of Political Economy and Taxation came in 1819 or so. And by then, capitalism had begun to establish. So by the 1840s, capitalism was the dominant mode of production in England. The capitalists had captured state power. So then Ricardo's labor theory value became very inconvenient for the ruling classes. A group of people calling themselves Ricardian socialists said that, look, labor theory value said that labor produces value. Therefore, all the product belongs to us. So these are the kinds of things that drove economists to go away from objective determination of value to subjective theories where you can attribute price in a market to the interplay of demand and supply, and demand can then be linked to people's preferences across different commodities. This is quite absurd because, you know, you just think about it. What is the demand for a commodity in a market? Is it only a function of preferences that people have? No. If I have preferences but no money, how do I count? I don't even count in the market, right? So any particular demand situation in the market rests on a prior distribution of wealth and therefore of income, which then determines the demand for a particular commodity, you know, in subject to those constraints. So, I mean, I think, again, one can discuss each one of these issues over several classes. But let me just say that let's not mix up Marx's use of use value with mainstream economics' notions of demand and so on. So you don't ascribe a number to use value. Use value simply refers to the set of properties of an object, of a commodity, that make it useful to somebody in society. But if it is not useful, nobody will buy it. So I think we'll leave it at that. Again, we'll have to go over these questions again and again as you read, and you can come back to me later if you're not sufficiently clear after this discussion. The next question is about the specific way to calculate exchange value. All right, oh, that's done. Okay. Then question number five, since abstraction and equalization of labor assumptions are done on the basis of increasing labor mobility and de-skilling, would it mean that as time progresses, the accuracy of this assumption to understand the value of a commodity is ever increasing? But you see, the point is not so much to understand the value of a commodity. The point is to understand why we, you know, talk about value in relation to a commodity, because we refer to value as a social property of the commodity, that it is part of the expenditure of society, labor, time. You know, it is every commodity has been produced by expenditure of a certain amount of labor time in society. And the point of this is primarily to focus on how the surplus emerges in capitalist society. This is an obvious thing in feudal society. It's obvious in slave society. But in capitalism, the surplus needs to be explained because there is apparently a relationship of equality between the capitalist and the worker. They have a contract and the worker comes to work for the capitalist. So where is the question of surplus? I mean, I made a deal with you, right? So the property, I own the factory, I own the machines, and I have supplied the raw material, so the product belongs to me. Simple as that. This completely obfuscates the process of production of surplus and its appropriation by the capitalist. So the use of the category value for Marx is a very powerful tool to bring out that process by which the capitalist appropriates surplus in the course of production. And because it is analyzed in terms of the category value, we are talking about surplus value. We wouldn't talk about surplus value in pre-capitalist society or in slave society. Under capitalism, we're talking about surplus value because, you know, the value framework enables you to see it in those terms. And I think we can come back to this later if you like, but keep reading and then it'll become clearer. Many of these issues will become clearer for you. Marx defines the value of labor power subjectively. He doesn't quite do it subjectively because depending on social cultural aspects. What he does say is that unlike in the case of other commodities, that enters into the determination of the value of labor power, what he calls a moral and historical element. All that he is saying is, it is not a purely physical, biological minimum. In different contexts, it can be different. For example, as I said, I gave the example. In advanced urbanized Europe, the urban conditions of existence of the class from which labor power was recruited, wage labor was recruited, provided the basis for the value of labor power, which would be socially legit, in some sense legitimate. In a country like India, under colonial rule, the enormous deindustrialization and the accumulation of the population in the countryside, its desperateness to get some livelihood, meant that labor power is available at a much lower wage. So this is more about these social conditions that determine the value of labor power at any point in time. And that is what he means by a historical and moral element. Also note that as capitalism advances and workers get more and more better organized, and as productivity improves and, you know, technology advances, the very notion of what is a legitimate payment to labor power will change. It's a social determination. It is not a subjective determination of any individual, subjectivity in that sense. It is a social determination. So don't say subjectively. It is historically determined. That would be a more accurate way to say it. But in any event, the point that follows is well taken. Profit results due to appropriation of surplus value. In other words, surplus value, let me put it a little more precisely. Surplus value is a total excess of what remains of the capitalist after all costs have been taken care of. Raw material costs, machinery, wages paid to workers. So this surplus value is not automatically appropriated by the capitalist. He has to share it with the bank that lent him money, with the landlord who gave him factory space, with the wholesale merchant who demands a commission on what he sells. So, and also this whole set of working people who have to be employed in circulation, in the sale, purchase and sale activities. So it's not that the capitalist gets to grab all the surplus value that gets produced in his factory. That's why he always keeps saying, we are talking about the class of capitalists and the class of workers, not a particular factory, not a particular capitalist, and not particular workers. So, and when we say capitalist class, we really have in mind, in a very simple model, we're saying capitalist class and working class, but obviously in a concrete capitalist society, there would be all this banking would be there and the profits of trade would be there. All of this is described in great detail in Volume 1 of Capital. So don't jump the gap. Read it as we go along, it'll become clearer. Okay? All right. Now then the rest of it about profit earned. You know, first of all, the term profit earned by exploitation. I would say profit appropriated by exploitation. I wouldn't dignify it by calling it earned, right? So that rest of it, what you have in a question, the argument that theory errs by presuming exploitation. That's interesting because, you know, what are we saying? We are looking at an observed fact. What is the observed fact? One capitalist over time gets to own more and more assets, becomes the owner of more and more factories, more and more companies. This is fact, right? This is not some hypothesis in Marx's feverish imagination. On the other hand, the working people, by and large, remain working people. No, you have to explain this. How does this happen? Is it because these guys are idiots and those guys are smart or what? So this is where Marx shows that, you know, surplus value has to be produced before it can be appropriated. That is why you cannot trace it to trade. You cannot trace it to money lending. Ultimately, the source of surplus value has to be production. And then you explain how, in the course of capitalist production, surplus value emerges. It emerges because of the specific property of the commodity labor power, which can work for a longer period of time than is required to reproduce it. So there is a distinction between the length of the working day, which is, you know, 8 or 10 hours or 12 hours as the case may be, and the amount of labor time it takes to produce and reproduce the working class household, which is 6 hours or 7 hours or 5 hours as the case may be. And therefore, although the capitalist pays the worker the value of labor power, he gets the worker to work for a longer period than is required to reproduce labor power. So he gets the additional surplus labor time of the worker gratis in a way, because he's not buying labor time, he's buying labor power. And when he's bought labor power, the contract says I can use him from morning 8 till whatever time in the evening. So that is where the surplus labor time is there, and the product thus produced belongs to the capitalist. And when that is transformed into money, it becomes surplus value. So please understand, there's no question of presuming exploitation. You observe what is happening in capitalism and you try to explain it. And Marx's explanation is very convincing in that sense. Now you can't bring in risk, you can't bring in, you know, abstinence from consumption, all that new classical theory tries to do. Just cuts no ice, because at the end of the day, what is clear is the capitalist gets to appropriate the surplus, not because of abstinence or because of some other divine property of the capitalist, but quite simply because the capitalist owns the means of production. So it is a return to ownership. That is why I don't call it earn, as opposed to wages, which are earned by work. Profits are received on account of ownership. One must distinguish between income on account of ownership and income on account of effort. Right up to the CEO, there is effort. The pure owner is the pure owner, right? And of course, in the real world, these can be combined in the same person. So don't get too confused. Okay. Then there's this whole set of questions on productive forces. Okay, what role does land play in productive forces? Well, it's land is one of the elements of production, right? So natural resources. So what is land? I mean, is this the surface, or it is also what is underneath it? Mines, quarries. So this is a funny thing, that feudalism, landlords used to own the land, serf used to had the axes and other means. Well, look, the serf was dependent on the landlord. The serf was given allotment land in the landlord's estate. And so even the limited means of production he had were at the disposal of the landlord. The landlord could evict the tenant, the serf, any time he wanted. So there's no question as to which class had the monopoly of productive forces. The landlords did. Landlords had the monopoly of productive forces because they owned the means of production in feudal society. The few axes and other small items that the workers would have had on their estate, on their little allotment land, don't count for anything. In feudal society, landlords had the monopoly of the means of production. Not on productive forces necessarily, because productive forces keep growing and they are the product of, you know, collective work. So it is also true that, you know, within the limits of a feudal society, some peasants could get a little surplus accumulated over time and so on. And all that is part of the transition to capitalism from feudalism. I'm not discussing it here, but please read Capital, Volume 1, where Marx spends a lot of time discussing the transition from feudalism to capitalism, where, you know, what are the changes in the forms of rent and so on. Bourgeois economists constantly point out that the advancement of capitalism is made over pre-capitalist legislation, but while developing bourgeois theories, specific relations of capitalist production is ignored, and these theories claim to explain all of human history. How do bourgeois economists explain this contradiction? They don't even realize it. They don't even understand it. Mainstream economics is a completely ahistoric approach to economics. It is a completely deinstitutionalized approach. And it talks about general equilibrium models. It talks about economic agents. In the rarefied world of mainstream economics, we have economic agents maximizing certain objective functions, subject to certain constraints. So it's basically a programming problem, an optimization problem, an OR problem, if you like. So this OR problem is independent of institutional arrangements and property ownership and juridical relations and all the rest of it. So economists don't even bother with the fact that capitalism is a historically specific mode of production which had not existed earlier. To give you an example, and I had made this point also in one of the early lectures, that if you have had any exposure to mainstream economics, you would have learned that they use term labor and capital for factors of production. If you ask a further question, what do you mean by capital as a factor of production? Do you mean a fund of finance, or do you mean instruments of labor? And suppose economists say that capital, by capital I mean the means of production. Sometimes you get that answer, right? Because you're talking about production and factors of production. You can't say money produces something. You know, money doesn't produce anything. So you have to say, I mean the capital goods and all of that. Now, you see, clearly, think of, like I said, think of a savage sharpening a piece of stone and using it to fell an animal. Now, that is an instrument of labor, right? Does that become capital? It does not. It would be absurd to call that capital, right? If in ancient society somebody used a sharpened piece of stone to fell an animal, you would hardly call it capital. Now, I think this is an important point that analytical categories in economics have to be historically specific. Mainstream economics does not at all deal with this. For mainstream economics, there is no history. Economics is a universal science. It's just a bunch of optimization models that you need to build. You need to pre-create, you know, specify conditions for equilibrium, as well as what happens when equilibrium doesn't occur, and so on. So, you know, they don't even bother. I mean, for example, you know, how would you explain the fact that slavery in the US coexisted with the advance of capitalism in the US? How do economists explain this contradiction? They don't. They simply do not. Okay. Now, Marx's law of value does not state that commodities are sold at values, but rather, this is question number three, in under productive forces. I don't know why it's coming under productive forces, but okay. Marx's law of value does not state that commodities are sold at the value, but rather that commodities tend to exchange at the prices of production. Now, let's save this for later, because prices of production come much later and have to do with the need for in an economy with free entry and exit of capital into different lines of activities. There must be a uniform rate of profit on capital invested. So prices have to reflect that uniform rate of profit on capital invested. And that's why they deviate from values. So that's a later issue. Prices of production, how they are constructed, starting with the value analysis, but then modifying it to account for different combinations of labor and capital in different lines of production. That's something I'm not going to get into here. So I hope the questioner who's asked this long question, question three, understand that we are talking about in this discussion that we had yesterday on the origin of surplus value, we started with the hypothesis that commodities exchange at their values. The reason for doing so was that this would be to say that, look, capitalists are not doing any cheating. They are being fair. They bought whatever they bought by paying full value of it. And yet, under even these assumptions, there will be a surplus. And this comes from the specific nature of the commodity labor power. So in order to establish that point, we use that hypothesis. Okay, but in the real world, there are different levels of abstraction. So when I use the term prices of production in an earlier lecture to say that Marx recognizes that in the long run under capitalism, the price of commodity would have to be such that the capitalist will continue producing it, which means it must give him the going rate of profit. And that is the sense in which you move from values to prices of production. But that's a different level of abstraction. Here, the use of value alone in volume one of capital is to enable us to focus on the relationship between the two basic classes, capital and capitalist class and the working class. So keep it at that. Don't mix it up with what comes later. We'll discuss that as we go along. Okay. Dividend payments in the MC. Again, this is too concrete a thing. Dividend payouts. I mean, how does it make a difference? I mean, we are saying that, see, dividend payouts have to do with the sharing of surplus among the various property owners. The industrial capitalist, the trader, the banker, and so on. Or the shareholders across the entire spectrum of the company. So these are not primary questions. For example, the individual person who buys a stock and then sells it later, he's looking for capital gains. In the meantime, he gets a dividend if the company makes a profit. But this is not of any significance for society as a whole. So when we say MC, M prime, we're talking about, again and again, we're talking about two major classes. Two different circuits. Bulk of us undergo the circuit of selling our commodity labor power and getting a wage. The capitalist class starts with money and ends with money. And the logic of the whole thing is only valid if the money you end with is greater than the money you started with. And Marx's objective here was to find out how the hell does that happen. And rule out usury and trade, because these are only circulation matter. They don't involve any production. So ultimately, you must seek the source of surplus value in production. That's the point. Okay, then last set of questions. Questions are not very clear here. You use social media, we're quite content. We are not workers for this media site. No. Is there also a surplus? See, these are all things that have developed over a period of time, and we are not analyzing them yet. So I don't think, I mean, I can't even give you an answer right now if you ask a question like that. I don't think it is even important. Because whatever we do on social media sites may impact on opinions, but it is not production. There's no production that's occurring in that sense when you or I write something. I mean, you might say later on that all of this may contribute ultimately to knowledge production and so on. But when I write an article for a journal, I'm just writing an article for a journal. I'm not even doing it as a wage worker, right? There are very many different levels of abstraction. And essentially, Marx is focusing only on the basic class relationship. He's not taking into account all the complex and concrete developments that come in the process of growth of capitalism. Does the media company make a surplus out of you? Yes, you write for them. They pay you something, but they sell the paper, right? And they get money from advertisements. And obviously, they won't run the paper unless it is making profits. So in that sense, that profit comes ultimately from the collective labor of all of us. So that is why it is always better to look at it in terms of the capitalist class as a whole and the working people as a whole, rather than whether I am, exploited or not, or am I producing surplus or whatever. Because, fundamentally, it is about tech society as a whole. And the basic distinction is between those who own the means of production and run the production processes, control them, and the mass of people who basically sell their labor power. Because in a country like India, this is much more complex because we have a large number of self-employed people. So we don't have a simple capitalist economy here. We have an economy where half the workforce is self-employed. Again, so that will be much more complex. I'm not discussing the Indian economy. I'm not discussing any concrete economy. I'm discussing an abstract model, the capitalist mode of production. These are two basic classes. That's what Marx is doing. So try and deal with this level of abstraction. Don't think that immediately you can go from this to something concrete that you see in your daily life. That's something that is a transition you have to work through yourself. I'm not, going to give you kind of a categorical answer on many of these questions that keep coming. What are your thoughts on social entrepreneurship? How does it even matter what my thoughts are? I don't think it matters much, but anyway, or a better oxymoron that is compassionate capitalism. I mean, I can understand your interest in these questions because, today these are all buzzwords and we talk about social marketing and social entrepreneurship and so on. Let me put it this way. In a competitive capitalist economy, the guy who is very compassionate will get left behind. Okay? Capitalism drives each capitalist to act in particular ways. Not because he or she is happy doing it or, it's not subjective. It's just that to survive in competition, you have to produce a commodity and sell it at a price that will give you a certain share of the market. So, yes, it's possible there are spaces within this modern capitalist society where you can do some social entrepreneurship, maybe work at a lower rate of profit, sell it a little more cheaply. Maybe you can sell some of your goods at a time of crisis like this, practically for cost price. Those are all, events that occur. These are not what determine the dynamics of a mode of production. What happens with all these questions that I'm getting? If you all have a specific concrete situation in mind and you want to apply a very larger abstract model immediately to a concrete situation, it doesn't work that way. The model we are discussing here helps you understand society as a whole in a larger sense. Specifics in each context, you have to work it out yourself. Okay? All right. I think I'm stopped there now.